This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, we're going to do a number of things in the political venue today. Big surprise. We're going to take a pretty hard look back at the recently completed election and then talk about some forward-looking things. Guest today, newbie on the Think Tank, Paul Bentz, Vice President, Research and Strategy for High Ground. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And old friend here, Tom Ryan, Attorney and General Troublemaker.
Indeed. Thank you, Mike.
So here... First question, was there, I want to give my take on Blue Wave and then invite you both to chime in. I'd say this is about as much of a wave as you ever get. The Democrats picked up 40-plus House seats, 40, maybe 41. More importantly, I think in terms of understanding what was going on, the Democratic margin in the House electorate, the actual votes cast, was 8%. So to the extent that they don't have an even bigger margin in the House, that just tells you about how the districts are drawn. But in other words, it was about 54 to 46. That's about as big as I think either party is going to get in a 50-50 world. Number two, the Senate, I think, is too much has been made about the loss of a couple of seats. The fact is that most of the seats were in red states, and the Democrats won 70% of the seats that were up. Their problem was they had 75 and they needed 80. And that was, an almost insurmountable, unrealistic goal. Just because of the lay of the land. By the way, in 2 years, the lay of the land is almost the opposite. At the statewide level, and we'll talk more about are we a purple state. Don't want to get in that yet. But Arizona carried Secretary of State, Superintendent of Public Instruction, one of two Corporation Commission seats, 6 of 11 federal legislators, in other words. And that, by the way, that counts the Senate and the House. And that is the first time that's ever happened since the 1960s. So anybody want to contest that? I think that if this wasn't a blue wave, I don't think we're ever going to see one.
I think it was, but it was kind of a slow rollout. There were a lot of races that took some time to get a final result on. So that feeling of a big tsunami wave wasn't there. But when you look at the end result and you look at the numbers, it in fact was a blue wave.
Exactly correct. I think that's an important way to understand it, too. At 8 o'clock on election night, I would not have said blue wave. I would have said, where is it? What happened? Paul?
The blue wave is real, but I mean, one thing to bear in mind is that still, at the end of the day, more Republicans than Democrats showed up and voted in this election. What happened is Republicans usually
statewide.
Okay. In the state of Arizona, Republicans usually enjoy a 12 to 14 point advantage in the off-cycle or midterm general election. In this case, by the time early voting was done, it was down to 7 points, and I think it will be somewhere in the 5 to 6 range. So Democrats significantly closed the gap. I also think it's important to note that all three of those races that you mentioned, Secretary of State, Superintendent of Public Instruction, and Corporation Commission, all had female candidates challenging older Republican male candidates. I think it was not only a blue wave, but a massive shift in female voters.
Do you know what the other commonality in all of those were? In no case did they face an incumbent. A Republican Secretary of State had been knocked off in the primary. It's the same thing with Superintendent of Public Instruction. And there were two seats open on the Corporation Commission. The one the Democrats took was the one where the incumbent had been knocked off. The other person was elected, was a Republican, but was a non-incumbent.
It's an incredibly good point.
Right. So. One of the things that I see, too, in the way that Kyrsten Sinema, Katie Hobbs, Hoffman all ran their races, they didn't run them as Democrats. They didn't run in an ideological way. They also ran very positive campaigns, which is not what we're used to seeing. I mean, we see all these knockdown, dragdown fights like the one McSally tried to wage against Sinema. Mm-hmm. But I think this time positive work, being a woman worked and trying not to be ideological, I think we're burning out on a lot of the ideological political campaigns that are going
the
on.
The Senate race was interesting, I think, in that it was a race, first of all, two women, so the gender was not a factor in differentiating the parties. The other is that Kyrsten Sinema was the most moderate Democrat of the entire delegation. as was Martha McSally. But Kyrsten Sinema ran her race as what she was, which is a moderate across the border kind of candidate. McSally did not run an authentic campaign in that she ran as I'm a all in for Trump guy, and I don't think she really was.
I think from day one, Sinema was given the ability to run the general election campaign and appeal to the swing audiences of independent, unaffiliated voters, Republican women. She was able to do that from the outset. McSally ran a much more bruising primary and had less time to transition. But one of the biggest criticisms I've heard about the McSally campaign is the most personable she ever got was in her concession speech with her dog on the couch. That was the first time.
The greatest part of her whole campaign.
Right. Exactly. Some more personality, learning more about her from the outset really would have benefited her.
One of the things that I thought that Sinema did well, too, is she framed the debate early on. She framed herself and her campaign early on. We have been that has been missing with David Garcia as a candidate. It was missing with Terry Goddard, guys that I like. Fred Duvall. They waited until the general election started before they really started to frame themselves, and that's too late. I think that's one of the reasons Sinema was so successful. She got to the independent and the moderate voter well before McSally ever could, and I think by the time the general election started, the cake was baked for
Garcia. Senate. Was defined by Doug Ducey.
Yes, yes.
Well, it comes down to money and message. I think it should be noted that Sinema is a prolific fundraiser, had the money to run a very well-funded, well-executed campaign. She picked the perfect message for the audience to appeal to those swing areas. This was not the blue wave. One thing that's important to note is it was not a progressive wave nationwide. And here in Arizona, the progressive candidates, David Garcia, who went very far to the left in the primary when he didn't probably have to, did not do well. We also saw that in Florida and Georgia, where the Republicans were able to withstand progressive candidates. We also, Ted Cruz defeated Beto O'Rourke, the other sort of so-called progressive candidate. So the blue wave.
Whoa. Texas, when you come within, 4% and 3% in Texas, that's a stretch for a Democrat.
A loss is a loss. At the end of the day, now Beto O'Rourke running for president would be like David Garcia losing superintendent race and running for governor. I think it's a bad idea.
I think he's going to run.
And I think it's a bad
idea. And I think he's going to have a whole lot of support. He has become an iconic figure in the Democratic Party.
The vast majority of Democrats that won did not run against Trump. They made the decision not to run against Trump. They ran on issues. There may have been a handful that did run against Trump, but most of them avoided that. If you look at Sinema's stuff, she did not try to run against Trump. If you look at some of the congressional candidates out there that got elected, they were not running against Trump. And I think that was, the temptation would have been, oh, he's polarizing. I'm going to be the anti-Trump. And they didn't do it.
People who could have run against Trump successfully were in safe Democratic districts already.
Yeah, that's true.
We were talking, the margin this time, all of the action was in districts that were vaguely swing districts. Some of them pretty Republican, but not overwhelmingly Republican.
Look what happened in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
That was the home of Ronald Reagan, one of the most conservative areas in the country, and it went entirely blue.
I have a theory on that I want to run by Paul, and that is what happened in Orange County. You had a lot of very well-to-do Republican, probably not that socially conservative, but economically conservative, who had it stuck to them by the Trump tax cut, which was a tax cut that did not operate in high tax states like New York and California, because they lowered some rate, but they took away the deductions for home ownership, which in a place like New York or California can be huge. So those folks got stuck with a huge increase in taxes by a president who tried to claim that he cut your taxes, and I wonder if there wasn't some revenge there.
I think that's an interesting theory. There's definitely public opinion strategies put out a number that said 68% of voters in their latest survey showed up to either show support or oppose the president. And so we tend to think that this election was all about opposing the president. And they said 37% of folks showed up to oppose the president, but 31% of people showed up to vote in support of the president and his policies.
We got a break now, but I will absolutely endorse this election because he made it so was all about Donald Trump, even where he wasn't being raised as an issue. I think it was an up or down on Donald Trump. And some places it was up and others down. We'll be back in a think tank. We'll pick this up with Paul Bentz and Tom Ryan.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Paul Bentz and Tom Ryan. Let me throw out the next question by way of my interpretation. I think Arizona is not purple. I don't buy it. Why? This was a big Democratic year. But it's a one-time victory, okay? There's an underlying dynamic that still leans Republican. I think the Democrats probably do okay in 2020 because we have surge and decline. It's a presidential year. That's when Democrats normally come out. The real test will be 2022. Can the Democrats replicate the overperformance that they had this year? It's obviously wait. If they do that, then I'll say we're a purple state. But for right now, I think we're a red state that's on the outer edge of winnability for a Democrat. Paul?
Absolutely. Arizona is still a red state. You don't have to look any further than the attorney general's race or the state mine inspector's race.
My favorite is the state mine inspector.
State mine inspector Joe Hart won his fourth term with 51.7% of the vote. Despite a blue wave, they went for the Republican. Similarly, in Maricopa County, I know there's a lot of talk about Maricopa County perhaps being purple, but the only countywide office on the bill was the clerk of the court, and he won overwhelmingly. The Republican won that race.
That's like 50. State mine inspector.
It's a good bellwether. And I think in both cases, we're still red. I think voters still default towards the Republican candidate in the state. It's a lot closer than it's been in the past.
Maricopa was over. I told you guys during the break, I pulled up an old tape of something I'd done, 1980 election. And Maricopa was overwhelmingly Republican, and that pretty much all by itself accounted for the Republican role in the state. That's getting closer.
Yeah, it's interesting. The history of Arizona when it first was created was a progressive. I mean, our
Constitution?
Very progressive. We became a state in the progressive era, and the Democrats controlled the governorship, the House, and the Senate for a number of years until
it wasn't necessarily a progressive as it evolved. There was a lot of Bob Stump Democrats in this state too.
Correct. So. And what really changed the political dynamics, I think, in the state of Arizona was the aftermath of World War II, when a number of airmen and soldiers and everybody started to return to Phoenix. It was the rise of Barry Goldwater and the conservative movement.
And then you had conservative Democrats in the rural area flipped and all became Republican. And at that point, you have a Republican majority.
Correct. But I'm with you. I don't see Arizona as a purple state. I think it's still fundamentally a red state. But I think in order for the Democratic candidates to have a shot at statewide office, they have to do what we saw in this election, which is run as a moderate, because what's happened, we've seen the Republican Party move so hard to the right that there's this big, vast field in the middle that people like Sinema, Hoffman, Hobbs, they chose to, to occupy. So if the Republicans are going to leave that behind, Democrats are smart to pick it up.
Party dynamics make it difficult for a Republican to try to moderate because you have to get through
in the primary for sure. There's 195,000 voters who split their ticket and voted for Sinema and Ducey.
At least because there may have been some who voted for the other two to offset, but the absolute minimum number is that.
Sure. The raw difference between the Ducey McSally versus Sinema, yep, Garcia is 195,000. So those are purple voters. I mean, mm-hmm, those are ticket, yep, splitters. Those are independent, unaffiliated female Republicans, which are always a very swing audience, mm-hmm, that do wait to
even late, more so, I think, this time.
Correct. And late deciders. I think that made the big difference here. And that audience will grow. But one of the things that is, hasn't really been talked about because Sinema won is she lost pretty handily in several parts of rural Arizona, Yavapai, Pinal, that are growing, that used to be more Democrat bastions that are growing more and more red. So it may not be enough to just win Maricopa and Pima in the future. You might have to actually, you know, be competitive in some of these rural areas as
well.
I think
that reflects what we saw in the whole country, which is that while Trump is hovering down around 40%, there are states where he is sky high.
Absolutely.
The rural sort of empty corridor, you know, from Montana to the Dakotas and you know, places along that sort of axis, the Deep South, that really is Trump country. And the loss, on the other hand, as you pointed out, suburban Republican women who in the past always sort of played with the idea of voting Democrat but never did. Well, this time I think they did. Yeah. And that was a big part of the theory for you, Paul. I look at the Democratic. No, we're going to have to wait for that. The music is cutting me out. I will tease the question. Let me tease the question. Okay, you don't answer, but I'll ask it. I see two things. Voter turnout, Democrats cut the usual Republican margin by a whole vote. Anecdotal evidence that the youth vote came out, those lines at ASU. We haven't got survey data yet. Point number three, and I don't think there's any evidence on it yet, but did the Hispanic vote kind of off promise and never delivered? Did they come through this time? That'll be at the agenda when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, I teased the question. We have with us Paul Benz, Vice President of Research and Strategy for High Ground, and Tom Ryan, attorney. Question I teased was for Paul, my theory that potentially three things that impacted the Democrats' success this last time. One is they cut the Republican margin to, I've seen as low as 4%. Clearly, the Republicans normally had, I think you cited 12% margin off your election, down to 5 or 6 or 4. Number two, anecdotal evidence of the youth vote being up. Big lines at ASU. Haven't seen hard data on that yet, but I'm sure we will. And number three, maybe Hispanic vote. Don't know if they turned out or not. We will know at some point, but your take.
I think there's enthusiasm across the board. One thing that we noted is even before polls opened, 50,000 more independent and unaffiliated voters had already cast their vote more than 4 years ago. So there was enthusiasm among independents that typically don't show up in the midterm elections. 18 to 34-year-olds made up about 13% of the vote, which was up from typically about 8 in the midterm.
That's a big shift.
A massive shift.
I mean, you get changes in your overall margins by 5% here, 6% there. That's how you get
it. It's a pretty major shift. I think
so. You're confirming the anecdotal evidence on the youth.
We'll see at the end of the day what they end up making up. But bear in mind also, voters 77 years old and older had made up 13.5% at that point. So
always been still, high.
Senior voters showed up as well. It really comes down to who turns out around them. Yeah. So there was a lot of enthusiasm, and it was the second highest midterm turnout in Arizona history, much higher than people anticipated.
I'm ready for somebody to go talk on a college campus and say, kids, you know what? Those student loans you got, you know, you look at the size of those, you know, you got that. Nobody's going to touch my Social Security. The reason is you don't vote, you don't matter.
That was actually Beto O'Rourke's message in colleges all across Texas. He would walk in and say, I'm here because I'm upset with you. You don't vote, and your vote matters. It was a great message that he had. I want to go back to what Paul was saying, because I think there's some important stuff here. Why was there this surge? One may be the Trump effect.
Hard to say it wasn't part of it, because Donald Trump wrapped himself around that, and he said this election is a referendum on me.
Correct. But I'm looking at the legislative races and the statewide races, and I think probably more than anything, the Red for Ed movement was a huge energy source for a lot of these candidates. And one of the things that I saw, and I went to more than one district, if you went to any of the legislative districts on a Saturday or a Friday night, you would see multiple volunteers. You know, on Saturday mornings, you'd see dozens of volunteers. They were posting them on Twitter and Facebook. A lot of the Democratic LDs had headquarters, and they were pushing volunteers.
You're saying those were Red for Ed folks?
They were Red for Ed folks. And so you had ballot propositions that helped the Red for Ed movement, one that went down in a very—
That they wanted to go down.
Yes. But they were—
They basically kiboshed the increase in charter schools in a way that's going to make it very difficult for the legislature to come back on
vouchers and vouchers. And charter schools.
But the point is, I think that there was the Democratic Party for the first time in a long time actually organized. They actually had volunteers. In my legislative district, LD-17, which for the first time—
Oh, that's one of the most interesting ones, because of all the places where Democrats picked up a seat, that was the most Republican. That was the district of the Republican Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
That was the biggest surprise of the whole night, I think.
And the last Senate president was from LD-17, and Jennifer Pollock.
Chandler, for those who don't know the numbers. Most
Correct.
Don't.
Yeah. Chandler Gilbert. And but every time I would drive by that place, it was a beehive of activity, and it's not going away. You know, you'll see it again in 2 years. It's been impressive how they organized.
Democrats gained 4 seats in the Arizona State Legislature. 3 out of the 4 can be directly attributed to the education movement, which has been the top issue facing the state for the last 4 years. We saw 50,000 teachers march on the Capitol. It played a major role.
Is the district that wasn't?
LD-10, where DeGrazia defeated Claude Felter in southern Arizona. That was expected to happen.
Well, that was the most Democratic district that a Republican had a seat in.
Correct. So it, based
that
on
was the anomaly.
That was the anomaly. So, but Pollock defeating the third place finisher Ellen in LD-17, Chandler Gilbert in LD-18, which is the Ahwatukee Tempe area. Mm-hmm. You saw an incumbent defeated by a Democrat challenger to
district that may be evolving in a Democratic direction.
Absolutely. And then LD-28, which is Lieberman defeating Sims. In both of those cases, they had split delegations that went to 2 Democrats. Mm-hmm. When we talked about red state earlier, I often say that Arizona is a red state with purple spots, but not in a disease type setting, but in an area.
You know, I see a common thread through these are suburban areas
with really
these are
good
not,
quality
they're not pick,
schools.
Suburban areas with really good
they're not
schools.
Picking up seats in rural Arizona.
No, sir. They're picking up seats in suburban areas, high Republicans, a lot of Republican women with good schools. All 3 of those areas, one thing you'll notice is that they all have a commonality
schools.
Of excellent school districts and really engaged parents.
You can follow the 6A football championship and you can see.
It may be populated by a lot of Republicans who are at least mildly embarrassed by Donald Trump.
Well, there are a lot of moderate Republicans out there. You just can't get them through the primary. You can't get them through the primary. Jeff Flake is a perfectly fine candidate. He recognizes he's not going to get through.
Jeff Flake was the executive director of the Goldwater Institute. You don't get better credentialed than that.
Well, I think the Republican Party doesn't understand the purpose of the U.S. Senate. And so they went out and maligned John McCain. They censured him. They let Flake know, we're not going to work for you.
Jeff Flake, retiring, he looked at the landscape and said, I cannot survive a Republican primary.
Right.
I think that's accurate. And I think we had put out a poll a year before the election that showed him at a significant disadvantage to other Republican challengers. And I think the writing was on the wall. There's a lot of, as we talked about earlier, you got to at least navigate and probably in some ways embrace the president to win the Republican primary. That creates challenges in the general election where bigger swing audiences are, particularly Republican women and independent voters that make up the difference in the state.
If he wanted to stick it to Donald Trump, he'd run as an independent for president. You think there's any chance he has that in him?
No. I think he's done. Let's just talk about one thing that's related to all this. 2020, if Ducey selects McSally, okay, mm-hmm. if Kyle resigns, he selects McSally. McSally is going to go back to what she's always been, which is a moderate Republican.
Because she tried the Trump thing and it didn't work.
Right. She'll go back to being a moderate Republican.
And would be, I think, formidable in that role.
Well, but here's the problem.
She's got a primary.
She's got a primary in 2020 again. And and if Grant Woods, who's still making sounds like he wants to run, is he's the Democratic nominee, which I think he probably would be.
Grant Woods might have the same problem on the Democratic side in that
he's not liberal enough.
He is very much a moderate, and the Democrats have their own primary issues with that.
Older Democrat men did historically poorly in this most recent cycle.
Bill Mundell, who would have been a perfect candidate for
incumbent,
the ACC.
I thought would have been most electable on there.
Shapiro as well, several legislative candidates. I don't think it's a slam dunk that we just have to assume that Grant Woods would be able to survive a primary for those very reasons.
Who else do you see coming out on the Democratic
side? I haven't looked through the full list. I know Ruben Gallego was slamming Grant Woods about his – he used to be a Grant sits on about a dog person and slammed him saying you used to be a cat person.
I could see Ruben getting the nomination. It'd be a tough haul for him to win.
Here's one thing to note, though. If you really hated those anti-commercials and all the hit pieces, you're in luck because we're going to have a Senate race in 2020, 2022, and 2024.
Arizona's the place for – since Ev Meekham, this has been the place for politics. We've had something going on. So question about Arizona. This is for you, Tom. Have we lost our place as the nuttiest state in the union? Talk to us. North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan.
Here's what's going on. They're following the North Carolina mode. We'll talk first about Michigan and Wisconsin because it's a little different than North Carolina. Either last election cycle or two election cycles ago, the North Carolina leadership in the state went Democratic, and the incumbent lame duck Republicans then went and tried to basically gut the powers of the new office holders that were going to come in and take over as Democrats. The North Carolina Supreme Court ended up undoing a lot of that, but it set the model for what we're seeing going on now in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Which just elected Democratic governors.
And attorney generals and secretary of states, things like that. So, for example, yesterday in Wisconsin, they've done a lot to gut the powers of the attorney general and the governor. They shoved through 82 nominees that Scott Walker had up there. 82 candidates in one day for appointments. You may have a temporary win here, but I think the American public are getting tired of these games, and they recognize it. And now with social media and 24-hour around-the-clock news, it's more understandable what's going on. So right now the playbook for the GOP in Wisconsin and Michigan is we're going to gut your powers even though you're taking over. North Carolina is a different issue.
Let's hold on that for a moment.
Sure.
I want to ask Paul about this. Does that, so those Midwestern states elect a Democrat to top offices, the legislature, Republican, immediately turns around and attempts to gut the powers of that office. Does this hurt them? Does the electorate recoil and say, wait a minute, you're not playing by the rules, or is that too insider politics to matter?
I think it's a little bit insider politics. I think long term, there's a little bit of cutting off your nose to spite your face. One day you're going to be in power again and you're going to be sad that you've changed all these rules. There's definitely a little bit of truth to that. It's part of the reason why here in Arizona, we've a little more mature on those types of things, which is why we have the Voter Protection Act, because we were, 20 years ago.
Well, we have the Voter Protection Act because the legislature regularly repeal things done by the people.
Well, fiddled with what the people were looking for. I think we're just a little further along than that. So that's part of it. But when you talk about crazy states, you can never count out Florida either. I mean, you can't have a crazy state discussion without including Florida.
We'll be back in a concluding section in just a moment. We're in the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we have with us Paul Benz, Vice President, Research and Strategy for High Ground, and Tom Ryan, attorney, and we were talking about shenanigans in other states other than Arizona for a time. North Carolina looks like they have a case of out-and-out vote stealing.
Yes, it's not. This isn't.
By the way, this has to do with U.S. Congress. The Democrats have a 40-seat pickup. With this, it could be 41.
Correct. And with the Democrats controlling Congress, they may not seat, Mark Harris, the purported winner of Congressional District 9 in North Carolina.
What most people don't realize is that the House of Representatives is the ultimate arbiter of its own membership.
Right. It can expel him or not seat him, just like the Arizona State Legislature
Could they declare the Democrat a winner and seat him, or could they only refuse to seat?
They only refuse to seat. North Carolina gets to select its own representative.
So if they refuse to seat, it probably suggests a new election?
I think there is going to be a new election. I mean, here's what happened. Mark Harris, an evangelical Baptist minister, beat the incumbent Republican in the primary. Prior to his primary, he hired a guy who is a convicted felon, who purportedly is a master of processing early ballots.
Absentee ballots.
Absentee ballots. Thank you. Paul's correct. Absentee ballots. Unfortunately, his technique is taking them from people who are voting Democratic and not turning them into the voting station, which is a crime.
And there's a lot. I've seen videos with the interviews with some of these folks.
Correct. There's a reporter out of Raleigh, North Carolina, who's been doing an excellent job of going out and finding these people who are being paid $75 a week to go to homes of voters, misrepresent their purpose for being there as, hey, we're going to turn this ballot in for you, your absentee ballot. And in fact, what they did was they turned him over to this convicted felon who then never turned him into the vote. So some of these things were like Mark Harris would have 661 absentee ballots returned for him. And for the Democratic candidate, only four. I mean, the numbers were I may not have the numbers exactly right, but fairly close.
We're talking about an election where the current margin of the vote they've actually counted is 900. Any idea what the magnitude of the ballots that got trashed appear to be?
Well, it appears to be in the thousands. More than
enough to flip the outcome.
Correct. And the election board that's controlling that is refusing to certify the election. There are certain House Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives have asked the FBI for an investigation. Mm-hmm. This is a federal issue.
Federal election, right?
Yes. And if this turns out to be what it looks like it is, Mr. Harris and his absentee ballot processing whiz may be facing some serious charges here.
I think that the general point I'd make about voter fraud as an issue, voter fraud that we should be concerned about, is not an independent decision by one person, or usually it's inadvertent, to cast a vote to which they're not entitled. By the way, there's been national studies of that. When that happens, in almost every case, it's somebody who moved cross states and forgot or didn't know that they can't cast a vote in Wisconsin and then move to Arizona and then cast a vote here. You only get one vote, usually inadvertent and never more than a handful in the whole country. But when you're talking about somebody wholesale, wholesale. When you get into serious numbers, that's when you are talking about a completely different kettle of fish.
I think it's important for the listeners to understand there's a difference between election fraud and voter fraud. Voter fraud is when the individual voter does something he or she is not supposed to do.
About which there's almost never any real
Correct.
Instance. There is the occasional inadvertent one.
Correct.
Because nobody in their right mind is going to risk jail to cast one extra vote.
Correct. This is not voter fraud. This is election fraud, because it was an attempt to affect the outcome of an election on a broad scale. Arizona has an anti what we call ballot harvesting law that's mm-hmm. recently upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. What Mark Harris's campaign did in Arizona would be chargeable as a felony for collecting all of those ballots, and whether you turn them into the voting center or you mm-hmm. destroy them, it would be a violation of Arizona.
In Arizona, you're not even allowed to collect them, even if you turn them all in.
I think that's one of the things that's causing confusion when we talk. The rules are different in every state you're in. In mm-hmm. Arizona, we have the permanent early voting list. Lots of people receive mail-in ballots. It's a mm-hmm. pretty typical, common thing that grew out of this absentee ballot program mm-hmm. that's been around for 20-plus years. People used to collect early ballot request forms before the permanent early voter list, and you used to get those in so you could control your voters. North Carolina doesn't have that. They have this absentee program, so it's a little bit more
easy to have. Yeah.
It's a little bit easier to manipulate. But if the folks are out collecting ballots, getting people to do absentee ballots, collecting them and turning them in, that's fine. That's not
should
against
be,
the law.
Should be fine. You're merely helping them do it. It's the trashing of legitimate ballots.
The question is, if they trash legitimate ballots, if they voted people's ballots for them and seal them, that mm-hmm. would be where the problem
yeah,
lies.
Absolutely.
And it'll be interesting to see if they can how much of that they can prove, because there's a fine line there between what what is allowed and what is not allowed.
Well, is it all that fine if I take your ballot from you and say I'll turn it in and I throw it in the trash? I don't think that's a fine line.
That's a problem.
If I take your ballot and change the vote on it, I think there's no fine line there.
That was one of the things that was going on in North Carolina Congressional District 9 as well, is that some of the ballot harvesters were told if they, if some of you say, well, I haven't finished it, they say, give
let
it to
me, help
me
you.
And we'll let me help you out. Right. And then they would go and vote the not in the way that the person would have voted. And by the way, just to be clear, Mark Harris is the Republican candidate in Congressional District 9. We have had our president, Mr. Trump, Kris Kobach, the current Secretary of State,
soon to be out of a job
in Kansas, mm-hmm. Decry voter fraud, election fraud, and yet it's been entirely silent on this.
Kobach had a commission to do that. They couldn't find anything that fit their profile, and they quietly closed the whole thing down.
Correct.
Allegations of voter fraud are troubling in general, though, because it deteriorates confidence in the process. Mm-hmm. And in Arizona, for example, counting the 600,000 ballots that were dropped off, either that arrived on election day or dropped off at the polling places, it's an arduous process, but that is not fraud, and they were not found ballots.
And by the way, we're running out of time. I do want to make one little point about that, which is the fact that our votes take so long to count is actually a byproduct of a good thing. We provide multiple options for people to vote in early. You can mail it in late. You can drop it off at the polling place, which does delay the count. So I say, let them take whatever time they need. We are providing a lot of options for people to vote. That's a good thing. And if it takes us an extra week to count it, so be it. Thank you very much. Paul Bentz, Research Director for High Ground, and Attorney Tom Ryan.
Thank you.
We'll see you after the first of the year. Take care. Good night.
All right.